Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. If Eugene Bullard didn't really live, his life would seem like a fictional invention. The son of a former slave, he ran away from his Georgia home at age 12, eventually stowed away aboard a tramp steamer, went to Europe, became a world-class welterweight fighter, fighting amidst the likes of Jack Johnson, moved to Paris in time for World War I, served bravely in the trenches with the French Foreign Legion. After wounds kept him out of the trenches, he became a fighter pilot, the first African-American ever, serving alongside Quentin Roosevelt and Eddie Rickenbacker. After the war, he became a musician and a nightclub owner during Paris's jazz age, rubbing shoulders with Hemingway, Fitzgerald, Josephine Baker, Mabel Mercer, and Dooley Wilson, his real-life pianist, before Wilson portrayed Sam in the film Casablanca. As the 30s rolled on, he used his position as a nightclub owner to spy on Germans who would come into his club. But after returning to the United States in World War II, he fell into complete obscurity. My guests Phil Keith and co-author Tom Clavin tell the story of this remarkable man in their book, All Blood Runs Red, The Legendary Life of Eugene Bullard, Boxer, Pilot, Soldier, Spy. Phil Keith joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Phil Keith, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thanks, Rich. Very glad to be with you.
How did you first discover the story of Eugene Bullard? This man's life reads like something out of fiction. You know, Langston Hughes was his dishwasher at a club that he managed. He worked with Louis Armstrong and was an interpreter for Armstrong. He knew Paul Robeson. He knew virtually anybody in the first half of the 20th century that came through Paris.
Yes, he did. He had lots of famous friends, but the question is a good one. I was researching a book on World War I, and in that book, I was going to put in a chapter about famous aviators that were involved in the war, and I was looking at the usual suspects, particularly Americans, you know, Eddie Rickenbacker and the Lafayette Escadrille and all those folks. And it was in some material about pilots who had trained with the French and then transferred to the American Air Service when America came into the war in 1917. There was a little footnote down at the bottom of the page. Footnote said something like, and all the pilots who applied were accepted but one, and his name was Eugene Bullard. He was the very first African-American fighter pilot. And I said, who? I mean, I had not heard of this fellow. So that intrigued me, and I began an immediate search to find out about who this guy was. And once I got into it, as you said, there were like 10 lives and not one, all packaged together in this one guy. And that's how the story got started.
So from that one line, how did you go about finding his life? In fact, he wrote an autobiography at some point, didn't he?
Yes, he did. It was actually a project he tackled literally during the last year of his life. And it was something that he wanted to do for his two daughters as a legacy. And unfortunately, it never got published, even though he had an agent who took it around to a number of editors and publishers in New York City. They all looked at it and said, this is too unbelievable. Nobody's really going to believe that all of this happened, and yet it did. It's crazy.
Well, and so let's talk about that fact. How did you go about authenticating all of these various stories?
Well, there is actually one and only one archive that contains just about anything and everything that was ever written down about him. And that's not a lot, but anyway, the archive is located at Columbus State University in Columbus, Georgia, which was Gene's hometown. And I went down to Columbus State and spent a week poring through these ancient cardboard boxes full of material, and I got a lot of good information, of course, from that resource, photos and journal entries. But as you mentioned earlier, Rich, you know, he ran into so many famous people, it was really pretty easy to triangulate him And his story, by going to the biographies of other people like Louis Armstrong, Ernest Hemingway, and many others who at one point or another had mentioned their association with Gene, either in the war as a pilot or later in Paris as a nightclub owner. So there were bits and pieces scattered all over, and it was a task of really reaping what was available and putting it all together. Now, he did a reasonably good job in his own autobiography, which, by the way, he wrote out longhand on yellow pads in French, because his English wasn't as good as his French by the time he was in his later years. But in any case, we had to be very careful about verifying some of the stories that he even told, because, you know, frankly, he was not very well at that point. I mean, all of us, over the years, either inflate facts or forget facts. So it was also, we hope, a very careful process of putting all that together. But what was verifiable and what we did authenticate was pretty amazing. And, of course, that's what ended up being the book.
How does the son of a former slave and an indigenous Creek woman growing up in Columbus, Georgia, even make it to Europe in those days? He ran away from home very early, and somehow early in his life he got this idea of going to France, to going to Paris. Where did that idea come from?
Well, it's interesting because his family history indicated, and we were able to verify some of this, that his grandparents or maybe his great-grandparents came to the South via Haiti. And his family had been slaves working on sugar plantations in Haiti. And during one of the Haitian revolutions, the family that owned this business and the slaves relocated to South Carolina and then to Georgia. And, of course, the French-Haitian part of the story passed down to Jean's father was that in France, everyone is much more respected from a racial standpoint than at the time blacks were in the American South. And that was a tradition that had been passed down. And Gene really latched onto this, and he said, well, if that's true, I have to find this place called France. And as a young boy, we think probably about age 12, he ran away from home with a dollar and a half in his pocket and began his odyssey, which for the next couple of years really concentrated on wandering around the South. But ultimately, in about 1912-ish, wandered his way to Newport News, Virginia, and for the first time saw this broad expanse of water called the Atlantic Ocean, and took a look at a number of ships sitting there in the harbor and said, well, one of these ships must be going to France. And he literally stowed away on a tramp steamer, which wasn't going to France. It was actually going to Scotland. But the German crew found him, kind of took him under their wing as an amusing, you know, sort of stowaway. Actually let him work aboard the ship. And they put him off the boat in Scotland, and from there his adventures began, and he tried seriously to work his way toward France, which he, of course, ultimately did.
And that begins the first chapter of his various lives, and that is as a boxer. Somewhere right at the point when he was in Scotland, he starts working at a gym and eventually gives his try as a sparring partner, and somebody sees that he has some boxing talent.
Exactly. A very good talent, as a matter of fact. He probably could have been a leading contender for a welterweight title. He was never big enough to be a heavyweight, even though his dad had been a quite large gentleman. And the boxing cards that he was able to get on took him to England and then to Germany and then ultimately to France. And once he saw Paris, That was all he needed to see, and he said, this is where I'm going to stay. Now, as luck would have it, this was very early in 1914, and of course, only 3 or 4 months after he arrived at his dream destination, the First World War broke out, which begins phase two of his life.
Yes, he tries to enlist, but he's also too young at that particular time. And as an American, he couldn't go into the French armed services. He had to go into the Foreign Legion.
Correct. The French Foreign Legion was the only service under the flag of France where foreigners could enlist, which he did as soon as, I mean, the day that he turned 19, which was the minimum age in that era, he marched down to the French Foreign Legion recruiting office in Paris and signed up. Since he was a very strong and wiry kid, the sergeant in charge of his company picked him to be a machine gunner. He was about the only strapping young man available to carry the company's machine gun. And off they went directly to war. And by February of 1915, he was in the trenches, and he told some absolutely horrible stories about life in the trenches, which he remained in for all of 1915 and into early 1916. He was wounded a couple of times. He was very brave. He had won a number of medals for valor, a Croix de Guerre and the French Military Medal, which is the second highest medal that France presented. And by mid-1916, he had been wounded very seriously, evacuated from the trenches, and was recovering in Lyon, down in the southern part of France. And the doctors told him, well, you know, you're done. You've done your part. We thank you very much, but you will not be able to go back into the trenches. And he said, but the war's not over. I wish to continue to help. And they said, well, sorry, but we can't send you back to your old regiment. But quite by chance, he discovered from another companion who was also recovering at the same hospital, but had been in the air service, that even though he was not qualified to go back into those horrible trenches, he was qualified to submit an application for flight training, which he did. And as soon as his wounds had healed sufficiently, he successfully went off to first aviation machine gunner training, a logical transition, having been a machine gunner on the ground, but quickly got into pilot training, really based on a bet that he had made with one of his friends, the friend saying, I'll bet you $2,000 you can't make it. And Gene said, I'll take that bet. And as determined and persistent as Gene was, literally throughout his life, he did get through pilot training. And in September of 1917, after finishing several training courses, he took off on his first mission as a pursuit pilot, which is what a fighter pilot was in those days, and literally became the first African-American fighter pilot in history.
My guest today is Phil Keith, the author and military history writer. He's co-author with Tom Clavin of All Blood Runs Red, The Legendary Life of Eugene Bullard, a boxer, a pilot, soldier, spy. And it is a remarkable life of this American who lived most of his life in France, served in the French military as a pilot. He later became he was a boxer first and knew people like Jack Johnson, the heavyweight champion of that time. Later, he ran a nightclub, several nightclubs in Paris in the 1920s, running into people like Louis Armstrong and Josephine Baker. Langston Hughes was a dishwasher at his club. Ernest Hemingway, the whole list just goes on and on. Later, he would also serve in World War II. He would spy as the rise of the Nazis came about in the 1930s. An amazing, amazing life, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, once he becomes a pilot and America comes into the war, this is where that footnote comes in, because all of the expatriates who were fighting on behalf of France, who were American, moved over to the American Armed Services. Of course, American Armed Services are highly segregated. They want no part of Eugene Bullard.
That's right, Rich. That's an unfortunate part of his story, but a very important one. The rules and regulations of the American Air Service in 1917-1918 prohibited blacks from participating in the aviation services. They couldn't even become aircraft mechanics, never mind pilots. And sad to say, it was official American War Department policy that blacks were not sufficiently competent to undertake pilot training. A sad testament to state of affairs in those days. So Gene, among his American companions who had applied to transfer to the American Air Service, was left behind. He continued to fly for France. He actually flew, we think, somewhere in the range of maybe 50 missions or so. We believe shot down at least two enemy aircraft. He had a couple of narrow escapes of his own in the air, which makes for exciting reading in the book. And unfortunately, though, in early 1918, he and his mechanic got a pass to go to Paris on an overnight, and they enjoyed themselves at dinner and slept in a little bit. They had to get back to the base the next morning, and they were running a little late. They missed the train, so they started trudging down the road back to the base. A French Army truck comes by. Gene flags it down and asks for a ride, which the driver said, sure, hop in the back. Gene goes to jump in the back of the truck, and he's rudely pushed out of the back of the truck. And he tries to get in the truck again, and a foot comes out, pushing him in the chest, keep him from entering the truck. Well, Gene, being the feisty character he always had been, grabbed the fellow's boot and pulled on it, yanked the guy out of the truck, punched him, and threw him into a ditch. Unfortunately for Gene, who was an enlisted man, the guy that he threw into the ditch was an officer, and that didn't fit too well with the French authorities. One particular enemy of Gene's wanted him court-martialed and thrown out of the service, but his squadron commander managed to protect him enough to get him back to his old regiment, although in a non-combat capacity. But sadly, that bounced him from flight status, and he spent the rest of the war literally pushing a broom or pushing paper. He got out in 1919 early, went back to Paris, and since there were no jobs for ex-fighter pilots, he decided to try something else. He fell in love with jazz and decided, okay, I'll become a jazz drummer. So he gets himself a set of drums and some rudimentary lessons from a friend of his and starts banging away, and he was absolutely terrible. But he was persistent and kept at it, and within a few months, he was actually on the drums at one of the leading nightclubs in Paris, and that began the next phase of his life as he worked in his way up to managing the club and then actually owning a couple of clubs of his own, as you said a few minutes ago. So he spent most of the 20s and 30s in the nightclub business, hanging out with some pretty impressive people. And one of the great ironies, we always have fun with this, is that we discovered, and you'll remember this, I'm sure, Rich, how many times have you seen the movie Casablanca?
Right.
Well, there's a fellow in the movie who's a piano player. Sam. Play it again, Sam. Well, the guy's real name was Dooley Wilson, and he was Gene's piano player in his club in Paris. before he was cast as Sam in the movie Casablanca. Crazy stuff this guy always ran into.
My guest today is Phil Keith. His new book is titled All Blood Runs Red, which was, I believe that was the phrase that he put on the side of his airplane. And I wanted to talk about that, how he grew up in the American South in, you know, the late 1890s, early 1900s, and had this sense of absolute equality. But this was a man that never put up with any idea of racial superiority by others in his life.
Yes, that's quite true. And I think it, in many ways, sustained him and allowed him to take on the challenges, the many challenges that he did, in fact, engage. He would just not be defeated. He would not be stopped. And it wasn't as if he was militant about it. He just wanted life to be fair for everyone. And in truth, when he finally did get to France, life was much more fair. The racial atmosphere in Paris in the early 20th century was much different than that where he had grown up in Georgia. It wasn't completely so, but at least more so. And he would always be quick to defend anyone who was being put down by any sense of racial prejudice. In fact, after the war, as you probably know, quite a number of Americans stayed behind and settled in France. And there were so many of them, especially in Paris, that they began subtly to change the culture. And unfortunately, they brought with them some of the anti-black bias that they had grown up with back in the States. And it became a real problem in France for a while.
And, of course, it was also a haven for American expatriates because Prohibition was back on in the United States. This was the only place you could come and get a drink.
Exactly.
I mean, legally.
Legally. And many clubs that had been totally without racial bias, some of them even succumbed to, you know, putting up signs where there were sections for whites only, just as was often seen in the South in America. Those were the times.
Well, through the 1920s and through the 30s, he, as you mentioned, started as a jazz musician, eventually works himself up to management and then nightclub owner. He's running a gym as a former boxer. And as you mentioned, he's running with an incredible array of people who came to Paris in the 20s, whether it was musicians, people like Josephine Baker. Perhaps he even had a romantic relationship with Josephine Baker, but blues singers that would come over that sang in his club, and a whole array of people.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it was quite a who's who of nightlife in Paris in the 20s and 30s. Of course, that ultimately brings him to the next phase of his life, which was falling in with the so-called Deuxième Bureau, or the French equivalent of our own FBI. And a Paris police inspector one day showed up at Jean's club, and the inspector had been watching activities at the nightclub and noticed that it was favored by many of the Germans who were beginning to infiltrate Paris. So knowing that Jean was a hero of France and had fought for France in World War I, he came to Jean and said, say, would you be willing to just, you know, sort of listen up among your German patrons, and if you hear anything that you think might be of value to us, maybe you would pass it on. Jean eagerly agreed, but with one condition, and the condition was that if anything were to happen to him, the inspector had to promise that he would take care of Jean's two daughters. The inspector said, yes, we will do that. And to help Jean out, the inspector also assigned to work with Jean a very talented and apparently very attractive young French woman whose name, no kidding, was Cleopatra, but everyone sort of called her Kitty, and she became Jean's partner. We also think possibly one of Jean's lovers, but they became quite close, and they worked very diligently on behalf of the French Secret Service. And these two were actually the first, we think, to hear from some inebriated German officers in the club about the 1939 plans to invade Poland, which they immediately went to their handlers with and said, hey, guess what we heard? And unfortunately, the information was completely ignored.
And of course, Jean seemed to have a charmed life for most of his life, but during this period, this was perhaps one of the closest times where that charm almost ran out. He was actually shot by a Corsican mobster who was also in another faction of the underground who thought he was being too cozy with German officers.
Exactly. Well, this is one of those situations where, you know, the right hand didn't know what the left hand was up to. You're right, Rich. There were two competing cells of activity working in this neighborhood in Montmartre, in this Corsican thug, although, you know, he was basically a mobster, was very loyal to his country and thought that Jean was working with the Germans. So one drunken night, he decides to confront Jean over it, and they get into a tussle, and the Corsican has brought along a gun, starts waving it around, and in the struggle for the gun, Jean is shot. And fortunately for him, though, even though the wound seemed to be quite serious, it missed every major organ, another lucky circumstance of his life, and he was able to recover fairly quickly and get back into the business. But then, of course, the real war starts, and the invasion of France and especially Paris occurs, and Jean has to close up his club, and his friends decide, you have to go. The Nazis are on to you. They're looking for you. And they do sneak him out of France through Spain and then to Portugal, and they get him aboard an American liner, and he sails back to New York and begins the next phase of his life, which is living in a country that he has not known for almost 30 years. He's more French than he was American. And Jean's story really got buried. We were very lucky to find it. And Tom and I are astonished that no one found it in the 60-odd years between Jean's death and today. But we're glad to have been able to pick this up and run with it. And there are a couple of happy endings. Of course, Jean, very late in life, was decorated with France's highest honor. But even the American Air Service, which turned ultimately into the U.S. Air Force, managed to redeem themselves in 1994. They posthumously gave Jean a commission as a lieutenant in the United States Air Force, which is belated but still nice recognition.
The name of the book is All Blood Runs Red, The Legendary Life of Eugene Bullard. Phil Keith, thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Phil Keith is an author and military history writer and co-author with Tom Clavin of the new book, All Blood Runs Red, The Legendary Life of Eugene Bullard, Boxer, Pilot, Soldier, Spy. It's published by Hanover Square Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.